This is the Perfectly Mentored Podcast with your host, Jason Portnoy.
Look, for those tuning in, Molly is a good friend of mine. She's a leading digital marketing strategist, educator, and entrepreneur who's trained more than 20,000 people across the globe. By the age of 24, she had risen from being an intern to vice president at an eight-figure digital marketing company. Now running her own business, she offers her students marketing resources, training, and support, usually reserved for top 100 agencies through her trainmytrafficperson.com and teamtraffic.com. She's also helped her students do everything from get positions at Fortune 500 companies to quadrupling their revenue in 1 month. For more than 200 episodes, she also served as the co-host of Perpetual Traffic, which has been downloaded more than 5 million times. She's also appeared on stages across the globe, including Traffic Conversion Summit, which, again, you guys got to check out if you're in the digital marketing space and social media world. Her book, Click Happy, was just released. She's also an incredible friend, mentor, and sounding board for me. And if you don't know who she is, I'm super excited to share her with all of you. Molly, welcome. Thanks so much for doing this.
Hey, Jason. Thank you for the very nice intro. And hello to everybody watching.
Forgot one last thing. She's also now the CEO of Smart Marketer. We got to put that out there.
We need to update that bio.
Look, you've had such an interesting journey, right? Bartender to intern to VP to now CEO. Yeah. One thing it seems you've always done is made intentional choices and intentional moves. You know, what can we learn about that? Like, what can people listening right now take from your journey to apply to themselves?
Ooh, good question. I was watching your interview with Ryan yesterday and I'm like, wow, Jason's a really good interviewer. I need to be on my game tomorrow.
Oh, I'll bring it.
So I think if I look back, and what's fun about this book is it really forced me to sit down and look back over the last 8 to 10 years. And I like that you use the word intentional, because I do think, especially over the last few years, I've done a better job of being more intentional in my life. But I think really what's gotten me where I am here, or when I look at like the big moments or what I'm really proud of, it was being intentional in how I wanted to feel and like how I wanted to live my life, but also being flexible in the ways that that showed up. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's kind of the idea of, you know, people ask all the time, where do you want to be in 5 years? And I hate that question, because you would have asked me 5 years ago, I would have undersold myself, or I just don't believe you always know exactly what it's going to look like. So for me, throughout my life, I've tried to focus more on, you know, I want to be happy and fulfilled, and I want to feel free, and I want to be able to travel, and more so look at it from that perspective, and then kind of see what shows up, you know, when I'm doing the work and like living that way. So, you know, that has aided me. And I never planned to be in digital marketing. You know, I didn't even own a laptop when I started as an intern. And that's definitely not the intention that I had put out there, but I'm so grateful for it. And, you know, it's been an amazing ride. So I don't know if that quite makes sense, but I see a lot of people who get very much caught up in the way things look, or, you know, I want to be a CEO, or, you know, they're very specific in what it looks like. And then when life doesn't work out that way, their expectations aren't met and they feel disappointed or they think less of themselves. And I just think there's a way to avoid that and, you know, be happier while also being intentional.
Yeah, I want to go even deeper on that for a second, because you have a lot of people right now who spent the last 2 months at home, right? Yes. Either having to figure out what business they're going to start now because their businesses stopped or halted or came to an end, or trying to figure out, or had time to self-reflect and try to figure out what they want to do. What have been your guiding principles when making these intentional choices? And you talk a lot about your daily practices. I want to give something that the listeners could actually bring home and put into place in order to carve out their space.
So like what's the question again? Like
what's your North Star? Like, how do you make all these decisions? How do you know when to pivot? How do you know what you're doing?
Yeah, well, it's changed over time. obviously, as I've grown up and become more aware and figured out how life works, I've been able to be more intentional about it. But for me, I mean, most decisions are based off of how I'm feeling. And that's not a popular opinion still in the business space. You know, how many times do you hear like, take the emotions out of business? And like, for me, that's impossible. You can't take people out of business. You can't take emotions out of business. I mean, business is selling things to people. Business is working with people on your team. I mean, it has everything to do with people and the way that those people feel and the way that you feel. So for me, I've always wanted to have fun and feel good. And it sounds simple, but that is really the goal. And so I think that I've known to pivot in my life when I'm not happy or when I feel that a certain situation has served me and it's time to move on because it's not fun anymore or it doesn't feel good. So I think that we've been taught to sort of unlearn our intuition in a lot of ways. And we've been taught that success is hard, right? And you've got to hustle and grind and then it's going to be painful. And of course there's going to be pain in life. I mean, that's part of it, but it doesn't always have to be that way. And you can enjoy your life. You can enjoy your work. You can enjoy working out and exercising, you know, and I've looked back and thought about everything that I've been taught or thought that it has to be painful. And it doesn't have to be. So for me, it's that I really guide even in business off of how I feel. And again, not the most popular opinion. And that's why I do balance that working with people that are more logical. And I definitely need that check, but I'm grateful for it. And I'll continue living that way for sure.
So let's talk about one of the biggest moves you made was the decision to write this book, which, yeah. I mean, you could have written 4 years ago. You could have written 3 years ago. Why now?
Yeah, I don't know. I was working with James Schramko as a business coach about 2 years or so ago. And he had written a book that I really enjoyed reading. And he had explained like what, not only what it had done for him personally, but also for his business and connection to the audience. And I'd also seen the power of Ryan writing a book while I was a digital marketer and what that did for him. So Schramko just kind of nudged me, encouraged me to do it. And my friend, Laura Gale, who we were talking about before we hit record here, that's actually what she does. That's her business. So she ghostwrites books for people, specifically in the business and marketing space, usually. So it just kind of all came together, but it was a long process. It didn't have to be. I definitely delayed the process. I think I had a lot of fear about putting the book out because it is vulnerable. And there are, you know, stories in there that I don't talk about really. And it's a step out. You know, I'm used to teaching tactical marketing information and I love that, but this book is a lot deeper. And so there was a lot of fear around it, a lot of procrastination on my part, but it feels good to get it out there. And I think that there's something about a book. Of course, there's a credibility aspect to having a book and to being an author, which is good for, someone with a personal brand. But I also like a book is just, it is so accessible to so many people. You know, it's something that my grandmother read. It's something that my family's been able to read to better understand what I do and my friends that aren't in this space. And so I just like that about a book versus a podcast or a webinar that, you know, feels more for people that are tech savvy. There's something about a book that just feels good and like everlasting. So
like cementing your legacy pretty much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think I'll write a few more books. And I think about the books, it's less about me. I really thought, what book would I have wanted to read 8 or 9 years ago when I stepped into this industry? Because I think right now in digital marketing, one of the biggest problems we're facing is we don't have enough people, right? Like we need to increase the workforce and people that are able to work as digital marketers, especially as employees. And so that's really who I wrote this book for. And I think that as my life progresses, you know, there will be like this shift into becoming a CEO, for example. You know, I would love to share that story in a book one day. So I think what's fun about books are, especially if you're just telling your story, this is what happened, you know, in my life. And like, here are the biggest takeaways and how they apply to you. I think that those are some of the best books. So.
One thing I love about you is you love actually helping people legitimately. You're in a space that actually helps people. Recently, I've been doing a lot more coaching and consulting aside from having the agency and taking on clients. And I absolutely love it because I love working with the person and seeing the immediate impact. Why did you decide to do what you do in the educational space? I mean, you have such an incredible gift. You could have been selfish and sat there and said, look, I'm just going to make money and focus on clients that are going to pay me a ton of money. Why did you go into the space of wanting to help people?
Well, it started when I was working at Digital Marketer and I just started dipping my toe into producing content. And really that was something that Ryan encouraged. It's just something that was really needed at the company at that time. And so it wasn't something that I said, okay, I'm going to be a teacher. It just sort of happened. And that's one of the stories I tell in the book is at Traffic and Conversion Summit in 2013, I believe, or 2014, this story about me finding out that I was going to speak like 3 days before we were going to San Diego. And it was really scary. And I was like nauseous for 3 days. I was so nervous. And I'm so glad that that happened because I found a gift of mine, which is public speaking and teaching. And I probably wouldn't have put myself in that situation if Ryan wouldn't have encouraged it, but definitely read that story in the book. So I guess the first part is, you know, I didn't intentionally seek out being a teacher. So I'm really grateful for the people that helped me figure out that was a gift. But I think once I figured it out and once I realized I enjoyed it and kind of what was happening and I started seeing like, whoa, I can help someone and then, you know, they make money and they're able to hire people or send their kid to school or whatever those effects are in the world outside of just making money. That's when I really started to realize like, cool, this is something that I want to do the rest of my life, you know, and it might not always be digital marketing, right? I might not always be interested in Facebook ads, but, you know, I'm grateful for the ability to connect with people because I want to share whatever I'm experiencing, whatever I think can help them. And so I think that for me, there was a point, you know, I grew up in Kentucky, not poor, but definitely just like regular middle class America. And I don't require a lot of money, really. And I realized that a few years ago that I had been chasing money or maybe like fame of some sort or like likes on Instagram because that's sort of what I was modeling or what I was taught or just what I thought at the time. And so, you know, I had this shift to where, of course, we're a business and I want to make money and there are exciting things that you can do with money, but what makes me feel good is helping people. And when our students get results and I don't know if that fully answers your question, kind of going down a rabbit hole there, but I think that there comes a point for everybody where there has to be more to it. You know, like eventually there has to be more than just wealth generation, or I don't know, it just gets unfulfilling, or to me it would become unfulfilling.
Well, you could have both, right? Like you could be happy and make money. I feel like sometimes people make it seem like you have to choose one or the other. Like, no, I'm chasing the money. Stop chasing the money, chase the happiness. You could actually have both. There are people who do what they love every single day and make a lot of money.
Totally. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with it at all. It's just, if that's your only guiding light, like if that's your North Star, or I think a lot of people that don't have money, like when I didn't have money, money was the most important thing to me, you know? But what I'm saying is once you satisfy that, there comes a certain time where you're like, that is more satisfied than it was before. You start to realize, okay, there are other currencies here. Like there are other reasons that I'm doing this. And that's when it becomes really fun and fulfilling.
I want to get tactical now. because I think there's a lot of people listening that could benefit from a lot. And not that what we were talking about in the beginning wasn't helpful for people. But talking Facebook ads specifically, for example, you've helped thousands of students. You've audited even more accounts. What do you see as the biggest mistakes, the common mistakes people are making?
I could create a top 10 list. That would actually be a good piece of content. No, people are generally doing a good job. I mean, the first one, and this is marketing in general, is just the offer, right? They think it's a Facebook ad problem. They think it's a traffic problem, but the issue is the offer, right? They're either asking someone to do something too early in the relationship, or the way that they've positioned the action that they're requesting from those people is just not interesting. So, I mean, I would say, especially like, for example, I teach a 4-month mentorship called Train My Traffic Person, which you help out with, Jason, and I appreciate that a lot. And the first month of the class is really tough because it's all about offers, and people want to dive into the ad stuff, right? Like, they're hopping on the Q&A calls and in the Facebook group, and they're like, Molly, how many ad sets, how many ads, like bidding, budget. And I'm like, guys, I promise you that we will get there. But if you miss this part, it's not going to work, you know? And the people that skip ahead, then 6 weeks in, it's like, my campaigns aren't working. And then we figure out it's the offer. Then we go back and fix the offer. And, you know, like you can't skip it. So you're either going to work on it now, or you're going to work on it, you know, later after you've wasted money. So, you know, I think that's the biggest mistake that I see. Another one would be just not understanding the platform. Facebook is a really complicated platform that, Jason, you and I probably know. We probably have like a 1% understanding of how it even works. And this is what we do in our career, right? Yeah. We nerd out about this platform every day, and we do not even begin to have the full picture. So I think that this really black and white understanding of it, that is our fault as like influencers or gurus and people in the space. A lot of the way that we get people's attention is by saying, hey, look how I spent $1.5 million on this Facebook campaign and made $2.5 million. You know, like, we're guilty of that. We just released a pre-sale article a few weeks ago from Smart Marketer with that headline. And why? Because it works, right? It's what catches people's attention, but it feels so simple, right? It's like, oh, well, I can do that. And it's like, of course you can do it, but there's a lot of work that goes into it. So I think that people not understanding how the platform works in terms of the auction, the algorithm, and even as a consumer, but also just having unreasonable expectations. Like, hey, Molly, I set this campaign up. Why am I not seeing a 10 return on ad spend? And it's like, well, you spent 30 minutes and you slapped this like bullshit campaign up. And this takes time. You know, this takes, you know, sometimes 10, 20 hours, especially when I'm first working in a new account. So that's really, it's the offer, and then just not understanding how the platform works and not realizing that this stuff is hard. Even though it seems simple, when you go into Ads Manager and click create a campaign, it's like, cool, 20 button clicks and this campaign's launched. It's like, there's so much more that goes into it if you really want to scale and do a good job.
And I love how you didn't once say, oh, it was the wrong, you increased the bid by too little or by too much. And one of the things that I like about you is, and we talk about this a lot, is I think what made us both really good media buyers is that we understand marketing as a whole. We're marketers, right? I don't consider myself a media buyer. I consider myself a marketer. And because we have that holistic approach, media buying just became a little bit easier to us. And, you know, the technical side of things, there are people who are way, way, way better. But there are people who chase the hacks all the time, and they're looking for that latest, like, what's the hack? And that's not sustainable. Why do you think so many people miss that key component about, you know, just focusing on the media buying side only?
Well, a lot of it is what they are sold. Like I said, looking around the digital marketing industry, you know, a lot of people have the expectations of the platforms that they do because of what the gurus and the leaders, like how it's being presented. So first and foremost, that's on us.
Also sexier to say, here's how to 5X your dollar versus here's how to really do a research on your avatar, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of like a chocolate covered carrot in a way. And yeah, so I think that's part of it. I also think that people don't want to accept how much work it is because they don't want to have to do the work, you know? And so it's easier to think that it's the button pressing that matters because that's something that you feel like you have more control over. And it's also just easier, right? It's like, it's tangible almost. It's like right in front of you where going and doing audience research for 5 hours or like truly being empathetic and putting yourself in the shoes of the person that you're trying to speak to, like that's a lot of work. And so I think it's people just feel like they want more control. And I think they also don't want to do the work. And I think they've also been sold that it's easier than it is.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I was very interested in magic tricks and I love magic. And I wanted to do magic and do all these things. And then I'd buy these kits and I'd buy all these magic kits. And I realized how much work and practice has to go into it versus like, hey, I thought I could snap my fingers and really make something appear.
Or you thought it was going to be like the thing that was in the kit that has like the secret door that's going to like make it happen.
Exactly.
Performance.
And I'm learning to make this ring disappear. I got to cut a hole in my pants. I got to put a string there. I got to do all these things. And there's so much work that goes into it. It was like, this isn't fun. Like, I feel like that's how people look at paid media. They're like, oh, wow, I could really put this in. I could get money back. It's an ATM machine. And then the work that goes into it, they're like, oh, this doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's why this is such a valuable skill set to have, right? It's not just a profession. This is a skill set. And that's why, like, that is a mind shift that I really try to get across to my students when we first start working together. Because it's not about you coming through my course and having this checklist of like, all right, if I'm setting up this type of campaign, this is exactly what the budget needs to be. It's not about micromanaging those little details, right? You have to think about media buying as like, if you were learning to be a carpenter and you were learning to build stuff, it's all, there are so many variables, right? And it's like, the first thing you have to think about is what am I gonna build? And that's gonna affect the supplies that you use, the tools that you use, and which sequence that you use them. Media buying is very much that way. So if you don't learn the big picture and you don't learn this as a skill set and it's more something you try to memorize or make it a super like granular step-by-step process, like not only will you miss the big picture and it won't work, but those tactics will become out of date in like a month and you will be living constantly in a state of stress, which none of us want. So I think the best way to think about media buying is a skill set so that it's like, cool, Jason, like we're going to set up a Facebook campaign. Well, if you or I were going to set up a Facebook campaign and a new ad account, there are probably 100 questions we would ask one another if we were working together to build this campaign. It wouldn't be like, okay, we both know to go in and press the same buttons. There's just so much more to it than that. And because of that, this is a valuable skill set to have. You know, you can make a lot of money. And I agree, like making money is fun. And that's one of the reasons I decided to be a media buyer. You know, you have the ability to grow someone's business, but it is hard work. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight.
Ryan Dice talks a lot about the importance of understanding the customer journey, the value journey. How important is that for you and the work you do and in paid media and how you craft your campaigns and ads?
Yeah, it's super important. It's that concept or just the concept of a funnel, even if it's like cold, warm, hot, that concept is very important for anybody to understand Or else, you know, the first thing someone would want to do is run an ad directly selling their product to people who have never heard of them before. So, you know, not that that can't work, but that's why I said, like, the first month of Train My Traffic Person, we talk about offers. We talk about specifically front-end offers, whether you're an e-commerce business. Then we, you know, have a play where you can kind of run ads to a product page or a pre-sale article, and you get to choose what fits best for what type of campaign you want to run. Whereas with your an info business, you know, we want a lead magnet or some sort of webinar or free video series. And we talk to SaaS and local business. So, you know, I think it's especially important on the front end. Most people understand the concept of retargeting, and that's pretty simple. It's people really mess up on the front end and not understanding how to build that relationship and to give that value first. And it doesn't have to be run ads to content for weeks and then start retargeting them to ask them to buy something. You know, with Boom, we spend $25,000, $30,000 a day on Facebook on campaigns that run directly to a pre-sale article, 5 makeup tips for women over the age of 50, but the campaign's optimized for purchase. And the success metric of that campaign is CPA. You know, we have to stay within a certain cost per acquisition there, but we're still giving value first, right? I'm not saying it has to be weeks before you ask for money, but you do have to think about that, especially if you want to scale. You know, I'm not saying you can't get direct to product page to work. And it's where I recommend people starting with e-commerce, because I want to make sure that there is a pulse or proof of concept that the market even wants that product to begin with. But you know this, there becomes a point pretty quickly where you can't really scale past, you know, people that are willing to go direct to product page and purchase that physical product. So that's when pre-sale articles become important. That's when lead magnets become important for scale.
And that's how you really build your relationship versus a one-off transactional relationship.
Yep, exactly.
In order to create an ad that converts, what are the elements that are needed? Let's break down, like, for you, for Molly, what's needed in a killer ad?
Well, number one, we always start with the offer. So we already talked about that. Two is avatars and targeting. And if this is like a new account for me or a new product or a completely new avatar, then I spend a lot of time here. And I'm not just saying this to bullshit you guys. Like, I spend hours in forums, reading books, Amazon reviews, everything you guys have heard but need to know, talking on the phone, calling people I know that are this person, asking people if they know this person. Like, that is so important. And even before you get into like interest research or anything like that, just generally understanding this person, that's so important. So I spend a lot of time on that second step, especially in interest research, because, you know, with Facebook, lookalikes are great. When it gets to the point where you can just run a broad targeting conversion campaign, that's great. But to truly scale, from what I've seen, interest targeting is so, so necessary. We just ran a campaign at Boom throughout Q1, the one that I mentioned that spent like $1.5 million and had a $2.5 million return. 36,000 new customers generated. It was a huge campaign in terms of volume. And what was interesting about this is, of course, we had ad sets targeting lookalikes. Of course, we had ad sets targeting nobody, you know, everybody. But the top six out of the top 7 ad sets in that campaign, when we sorted by volume of customers, number of customers acquired, were actually interest-based targeting. And that just goes to show you that there's always a place for interest, especially with scale. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. So I'm a huge proponent of that. We're actually putting out a new product at Smart Marketer next month that's going to be really cheap but super value-packed, called Ad Targeting Blueprint, because I'm really passionate about this topic and I think it's where a lot of people mess up. So that's the second step. Then three, I move into copy. And a lot of times I'm already working on the copy while I'm in step two with targeting, especially if it's an existing brand that has testimonials and user-generated content. We just put out a new product at Smart Marketer called Ambassador Blueprint, and it shows how we built the ambassador program at Boom that generates like multiple amazing video testimonials for us every week. That's another reason that that campaign I mentioned works so well, is because that creative is so native. It just works. There's nothing that works better than that. And we've been preaching that for years, but we built out a cool system to make sure we constantly have those coming in. So a lot of times I'm reading those while I'm in the avatar research stage, and I'm starting to put them in a Google Doc, like, okay, this would be good for ad copy. So I'm like, I've got about half of it done by the time I get there, but then I write anything that I need to write from the brand's voice, or, you know, anything that's not going to be direct testimonials or quotes from other people. Then while I'm doing that, I'm also, because your creative is just the visual representation of the copy and whatever hook. So, you know, I always have at least three or four very different hooks that I'm testing from a copy perspective. And then I just make sure I have creatives that reflect that. So usually during the copy stage is when I'm also speccing out ideas for creatives. And I've got an amazing designer named Brittany that I've been working with for about 6 years now. You guys can look her up, Brittany's Designs on Facebook. It's Brittneys. So Brittany spelled Brittney. She's amazing, especially at creating Facebook ads. But the more, and you guys know this, the more instructions you can give a designer, the better. Because otherwise, they're going to create something that's beautiful. And that's not always what we need from a marketing perspective. So, you know, that fourth step is you know, just about specking out those creatives for her, making sure they're a reflection of the copy. And then, of course, going into campaign structure. So that's when I do think about the button clicking, because there are mistakes that you can make using the wrong objective or setting too small of a budget for an objective. Like, there are lots of small nuances inside of Ads Manager that Facebook doesn't talk about that are important to understand. But guys, that's like 5% of it, you know, or maybe 10% of it. So the last step for me is, okay, based off of what I'm doing, what does the structure need to look like? What objective do I need to use? Bidding, all of that fun stuff, and then get it launched. So yeah, those are my five steps.
Well, that was massive. And I encourage everyone who's listening or watching to go back and re-listen to that, because I think there's tremendous amount of value in that.
Yeah, and Jason, really quick, one more thing on that. What's fun is that if you have this sequence and you know this in your agency, it makes it a lot easier to work with a team. So, you know, Brittany knows when she comes into play. John knows when he comes into play from a data perspective. But now I can just check in, right? And give my feedback on the front end and kind of in the middle and at the end. So I think having that process is really important. And a lot of people, you know, for example, will wait until they're setting up the campaign, and then it's like, oh, I need an image. I'm going to go grab a stock photo, right? Like, this is 2020, guys. That is not going to work. So I know a lot of this feels like basic concepts, but it is what most marketers are missing. They're not putting time into the fundamentals. And yeah, I think that's there's nothing more important than that.
Couldn't have said it better myself, and couldn't have agreed more. One of the things that there's a debate in this industry about all the time is attribution, right? Yeah. None of the platforms play nicely with each other. It's something that's just not solvable. I don't care what platform you're using, and people sit there and say, this will solve it. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
What's your message for brands listening, and maybe media buyers who are dealing with brands who need to know, oh, I want to be profitable on every single platform. I need to know where it's coming from. I want to understand what's doing best. What's your message for both the brand and the media buyer that has to deal with that type of client?
Good question. I think first off, you can get pretty good attribution, right? It's never going to be perfect. And you have to understand that, especially if you're coming from the mindset of, I want to measure exactly the return on Facebook today or exactly the return on Google. Like, that's not a reflection of how a customer journey works in the first place. So it makes sense that attribution wouldn't be correct. And you also have to understand the fact that it's not even that the platforms don't play nicely together. It's that the platforms don't have the full picture of your business, right?
And so, they weigh things differently.
Yeah, well, Facebook is working from a cookie-based standpoint, right? They can't see into your CRM, right? Like, all Facebook can see is activity on your website. Like, that is how they're measuring. So I think that's first important to understand, like, why attribution can be off. It's because these platforms don't have access to all of the data and the full picture that you do. But I do think it's really important to invest in getting good data, in getting clean data. That's something that we did early at Digital Marketer when we hired John Grimshaw, who's now the CMO at Smart Marketer. You know, at heart, he is an analyst. He loves tracking. He loves numbers. And having the cleanest data, the most correct data you can, that is worth it. But it is expensive. It can be expensive to get that set up and to have that on an ongoing basis because, you know, it's not something, it's not just logging into Ads Manager, you know, it's like building out cool dashboards that look cool in Data Studio, Google Data Studio, but not just look cool, are actually correct. And I'm not an expert on this by any means, but it's, you know, bringing the data together, cleaning it, storing it, presenting it. That's kind of what I understand of it. So I think it's being willing to invest in that from the brand side. That's important and it's not cheap. And so if that's something that's important to you, you're going to have to invest in it, but it still isn't going to be perfect. So why waste your time chasing perfection, right? There becomes a point. And for me, it's usually around like when you're spending like $5,000 a day, I would say, across all paid media, that you really have to get out of the mindset of like trying to look at each channel specifically because it's just not going to work that way. So we kind of call it the halo effect. A lot of people call it like blended ROI or blended return on ad spend, whatever you want to call it. We're really of the mindset that we try to track to the best of our abilities and see how each campaign is performing. But we also know that there is this halo effect and these benefits to what we are doing, to buying media, that we're never even ever going to be able to track with a number, right? Like, you can't track. I mean, you can track an impression, of course, in someone's feed, but you don't know what that actually meant to that human. If they're going to recognize you later, if they're going to go Google you, if they're going to go look you up on YouTube, you know, whatever that is, there is this halo effect that I always see in every business that I've run ads for of all of these other things that start to grow as a result of paid media that you can't track. You know, most commonly with e-commerce, people that say, oh, whenever I turn Facebook ads on, even though they're not going to Amazon, they're going to my Shopify store, I see Amazon sales increase. And then I can't track it, but when I turn ads off, they go back down, you know? So I think that it's two-sided. It's investing in getting the cleanest data that you can and understanding that that is freaking complicated. And the people that do that work are geniuses. They really are. Like, bless them. That's definitely not how my brain works or where I'm at my best. So it is a big investment and it's really important. And on the other hand, try to keep things as broad and big picture as possible, or you'll drive yourself nuts. You know, I had a consulting client last year that spending like $20,000-$30,000 a day across different platforms, e-commerce company, and we spent most of our time together talking about their attribution issues and like, oh, this campaign is down today. Like, we're gonna turn it off and then try to turn it back on tomorrow. And it's like, guys, that is not where I like to spend my energy. You know, we could have spent that energy creating new avatars, ad copy, offers, like everything that's actually going to allow you to scale. So, yeah.
Well, I look at it as if you had a store, like an actual store, and you had a lineup around the block three days in a row. And then the next day you didn't have a lineup in the block. Do you shut the store down and be like, okay, today we're not opening. And then hopefully open tomorrow and there's a lineup around the block. Like that's not how real life works.
And that's why attribution isn't perfect. This is new. And just because we can track doesn't mean it's always going to be perfect. And I usually use an example when I talk about attribution. It's like, think about back when people could just do billboards or print or radio. I mean, what was attribution then? It's like, did sales go up or not? So also feel grateful that we can do what we can do, like versus being frustrated by it and living in frustration of like, why are Facebook and Google reporting 20% discrepancy? It's like, try to fix that, but be grateful that you can even track it in the first place.
and understanding that times are different, right? It's not a seven, you know, there used to be a rule. It takes seven interactions with someone before you make a sale. Seven is more like 1,000 right now, right? With how noisy our world is. Yeah. All these platforms have to play a role. And if they all take credit, it's because they all played some sort of role in it. So it doesn't really matter.
Totally. Couldn't agree more.
A lot of local businesses right now, I want to bring it local for a second, because there are a lot of local businesses who have been affected recently with what's been going on. What's the marketing play for them now?
Well, I think it's to first understand that things probably will never go back to normalcy as you saw it before. So it's like allowing yourself to let go of that. And I know we've heard the word pivot hundreds of times the last few months, but just staying in tune with, you know, your local business, you see your customers in person. Like that is such a huge benefit that you have over us as digital businesses, especially in regards to staying in tune with what's going on in their life and what they currently need. So I would say just really stay in tune with that and be flexible as to what direction your business wants to go. So one of my good friends from Kentucky, we grew up in Danville, Kentucky together. Her name is Elena, and she has a cafe in Telluride, Colorado, where I lived for a few years before I moved here to Amsterdam. She opened a cafe there, and it's called Ghost Town. You guys should look it up. She does great on Instagram and Facebook just as a local business. She's a good to model from that standpoint. But I like to use her as an example because she's always done this, like especially, excuse me, through COVID. You know, she was a coffee shop and before was basically just selling coffee and different salads and toasts and things like that. She obviously had to stop that when the virus hit. She was able to do takeaway. But she's like, what do people truly need? And it's funny because when I was living there, Telluride's this super small, like I think like 1,000 person mountain town in Western Colorado in the middle of nowhere, beautiful, amazing, but very remote. And I moved there from Austin and had access to like so many grocery stores and things that I took for granted. So I remember sort of complaining to her like, Elena, the grocery scene here is not good. And she's like, yeah, I know. I've been thinking about that. And so she heard more of that during COVID, especially since people were eating at home. And so she converted this cafe, like she's still doing coffee and takeaway food, but now she's converted her shop into a grocery store. And that's where most of her revenue is coming from. And I mean like produce, anything you would want at a grocery store within reason, she's figured out. She bought the fridge, like the multiple fridges. She's got the whole setup, the freezer. And she's like, cool, this is what I do now. Like, not only has this saved my business, but I'm also doing better than I was before. And my business looks completely different than it did 6 months ago. So, you know, simple example, but that's what I would be thinking about. Like I live in Amsterdam, as I said now, and I live over a Thai restaurant. So there's a Thai restaurant right below my feet right now. And it's been cool to watch him, you know, pivot throughout this time. He's like, I'm going to do takeaway. I'm going to set up chairs and table, you know, outside on the terrace. Like, I'm going to fit in, right? Like, I'm going to give you guys what you need right now. So I think that's really all you can do, and be willing to think out of the box like Elena did. A lot of people would have said, no, I'm a coffee shop. I'm a cafe. We're just going to do takeaway and like hope tourism comes back soon, you know, because Telluride relies on tourism. Her business relies on tourism. And she said, no, I'm going to change things up. I'm willing for this to look differently. This is a grocery store now. And, you know, here we go. So,
and I think that's advice, not just for a pandemic, right? The businesses that are too comfortable, you know, what is it like, fat cats get lazy, right? Like that's what happens. You're seeing success and you get too comfortable. That's how you get disrupted.
The pandemic just forced evolution to happen much more quickly than we used to. But those of us and those businesses that can do that regularly, that were already doing that, like digital marketers were set up for this pandemic. Our world changes every day. I read this really good article I'll share with you. I can put in the comments here. And it was someone who had worked in a marketing agency, and she was sharing some stats that digital marketing is the most stressful job on the planet right now. Like more than being a brain surgeon and some other jobs that you would think are incredibly taxing. And there are multiple reasons for that. But we live in this every day. You know, like we're used to pivoting. And I think it's especially hard for a local business that feels more set in this is how we've always done things. And yeah, that's not going to work anymore.
Yeah, I'd put an asterisk on that. I mean, ethical marketers are finding it stressful right now. And something that I always talk about is when we bring on a new client at the agency or a coaching client, we're excited, we're happy. But the first thing that always goes on my mind is like, what if we don't deliver? What if we can't get them results? Yeah. And I start getting a place of fear and be like, oh no, maybe like what if like, and that's why we'll never touch anyone where we're their last X amount of money or where their Hail Mary attempt. I don't want to be that. I take it very personally. You know, think about it. You're almost like a stockbroker. They're giving you their livelihood, their money to invest and hope you do well. Like, I don't understand how people can't take that seriously.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, you have to be able to emotionally remove yourself enough to where it doesn't affect you when things don't work, because that's always going to happen. Sure. There's so many variables that go into this stuff working or not working. But it is a huge responsibility that shouldn't be taken lightly. And I feel the same when students give us money. It is my job to over-deliver, and not just over-deliver and create a product that's good or that's exceptional, but to provide them a transformation, to push them, support them, whatever they need. Everybody needs support in different ways, but like to actually see that transformation happen. If that's not happening, why am I taking people's money? And you see that so much in the info space and all these launches and like people selling stuff without really caring if anybody goes through it or what happens after someone purchases the product. So, you know, I think that fear is because you care, right? Which is everything. And it's also, you know, I write about this in my book, but before any big like moment in my life, looking back, like good things that have happened, like this book being released, there's always so much fear. Like there's always darkness before the light, truly. Like these dichotomies exist in so many facets of our world, but fear is one of them as an entrepreneur, as a digital marketer. Like you just got to get comfortable in that stuff, because you know, no matter what it is, whether it's putting a book out, launching a campaign, bringing on a new client, you know, that fear means that you care, but it's also, you know, what you have to move past for something really good to happen afterwards. So it's not a bad thing always.
Love that. I think that's a perfect segue to start wrapping up. I mean, congrats. You're now the CEO of Smart Marketer. Well-deserved. What's the goal? What's your vision and plan now for Smart Marketer as the CEO?
Yeah, good question. Right now is just to continue to serve and do what we do best. You know, our motto, our mission is serve the world unselfishly and profit. That's truly what we believe. The guiding value is having fun, helping people, providing these transformations for not only business owners, but people that do this stuff that are more of the career-oriented digital marketer. I want to be able to serve both sides of the coin there and also bring them together, which is exciting. So it's continuing to help people and it's continuing to scale the business. So, you know, tactically right now, we're in the process of really beefing up and building our traffic system, which is super fun. So just introducing new front-end offers, introducing new products on the back end. Like, we're definitely, this brand has been around for a while. You know, Ezra's been, he created Smart Marketer 7 or 8 years ago, but it's always been sort of not put to the side, but his main focus is Boom and these other businesses that he has. So we've got this audience and now it's really time to build more products, build more offers, continue to build the audience more and kind of see where that takes us. You know, I'm not going to say in 5 years we'll be doing X, Y, or Z.
I know you hate that question, so I wouldn't give it to you. So don't worry.
Yeah, it's staying in tune with the market, like both of those avatars that I just talked about, figuring out what they need and providing that. So, yeah, it's a good time.
Love it. Molly, thank you so much. Before we go, I actually need to confess something. I think 3 years ago when I attended my first TNC, I think it was 3 years ago, I heard you speak. And after listening to you talk, I'm like, I need to meet this person. I don't know what it was. It was this feeling that I knew we'd get along. I felt like we saw eye to eye on things. I liked what you have to say. You seem like a legit good person. And I was, you know, trying to figure my way out in this digital marketing world. And I felt like you wanted to help people. So I never like thought I'd let alone, you know, meet you, but never did I think it would have turned into this amazing friendship. You're someone I go to for advice, maybe too much. I don't know you, but you've never told me to stop or shut up. So I'm going to keep doing it. So why is this important? Why is this important for the listeners to know and understand? It's because Molly has, you know, when I came knocking, it wasn't just me. I wasn't special. I'd like to think I was special, but she treats everyone that way and is super, super accessible. Thank you for all the advice you've helped me with and for my growth. Thank you for all you do for our community, the marketing community, and for businesses worldwide. And of course, thank you for agreeing to come on today and share your immense knowledge.
Thank you. This was fun. And I know this is called Perfectly Mentored, and I was lucky enough to have Ryan as a mentor. You know, and he really took me under his wing and gave me access to this world. And so, you know, Jason, anybody that I can give that to, that's a no-brainer. So, I look forward to seeing what happens in the future. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Love it. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for paying attention to that episode. Look, if you enjoyed it and you're looking to scale your business to the next level or just a bit stuck, we've worked with businesses and helped scale them past 7 figures. So we know a little bit what it takes to grow your business. So if you're looking for a free strategy call with myself or a team member to help you and help get you unstuck or help scale your business, head on over to jportnoy.com and book a free strategy call. I'll see you then.